It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show. If you tuned in because you saw advertisements for the show, you know that today's show features the National Academy of Public Administration. If you work inside or around the Beltway, everybody knows them as NAPA. NAPA's been around for many decades, an incredibly well-respected organization. And for many people who come to work in our nation's capital, they care about public administration. They care about public policy, not just politics. And if you care about public administration and public policy, NAPA's the place you want to go and talk to. We're very fortunate to have with us today the president and CEO, Dan Blair. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Deborah. How are you?
I'm having a good day so far, and it's a real honor, Dan, to have you back on the show. I know you've been on our show before. Dan has a very familiar name for those of you who come to work for the U.S. government. Dan's had two presidential appointments. The last position he held was the deputy director of OPM from 2002 to 2006. He thinks his favorite position, though, was chairman of the Postal Regulatory Commission. And but people still complain about the Postal Service, Dan.
Well, they do, but right. I think that it touches everyone every day.
It does.
It's one of the most visible signs of our federal government out there.
Yeah, yeah. And it really, you know, with all its criticism and all fairness, it's amazing how people, you know, what you count on happening every day in terms of commerce and everything else that matters. The Postal Service really, you know, people give it a lot of criticism.
Amazing institution.
It is, really is. Before that, Dan spent many, many years as a senior staffer in both the House and the Senate, working on the civil service committees, governmental affairs committees. And so I think a natural place for him to be right now is over at NAPA, where he's been since 2011. And joining Dan from NAPA is Joe Mitchell. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. It's Joe's maiden voyage to Fed Talk. Joe's been with NAPA for 15 years, and I said, that's okay.
I'm a teenager now.
That's okay. I've been at my place of employment for 25 years. I understand tenure. And Joe's going to be great. Joe is the director of studies over at NAPA, and if you go on their website, it's NAPA.
It's NAPAWASH.org.
NAPAWASH.org, and you click on their studies, you'll then get a sense of what Joe really does every day. He has his PhD and master's in public administration, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Dan for about 20 minutes before the show, and he knows his stuff.
It was great prep for the show.
Yeah, he knows his stuff. He knows his stuff. So we'll be digging into some of those studies. And joining us by phone is David Chu. David, are you with us?
I'm here, Deborah. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm really, really delighted to be able to have you as a guest. David also has a very long and noble career serving in government. He's currently the president of the Institute for Defense Analysis, but certainly I think he's probably best known as being the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness from 2001 to 2009. David, that had to be a very serious job.
Yes, indeed.
It was, during very serious times. David has also been a member of the board of NAPA, and currently co-chairs or has co-chaired several of their studies. So we're really, really honored to be able to have you. David's joining us by phone. And before we dive into some of the stuff that's going on at NAPA currently that I think a lot of people will find very interesting, Dan, I thought we'd start with you and explain to people, you know, what is NAPA and how do you work there?
I'm happy to do that, Deborah. The National Academy of Public Administration, finally known as NAPA, is a nonprofit independent organization that was chartered by Congress in 1984. When I say chartered, Congress actually enacted its letters of incorporation. We're a nonprofit corporation in the District of Columbia, but we were formed several decades before that by a series of wise men in public administration, like Elmer Stotz, who was the former Comptroller General at the GAO, James Webb, who was a former administrator at NASA. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they formed it was that here were very wise men leading incredible organizations at the time, and they could rely upon the National Academies of Sciences for independent, objective advice when it came to science. But they did not have a counterpart when it came to issues of management and public administration. So they wisely brought together a series of individuals who became the core of the National Academy of Public Administration. Hmm. We are one of two research institutions that Congress has chartered, the other being the National Academies of Sciences. We hold that charter very dear, and we're quite proud of that. And everything we do is to honor that charter and stay true to that charter.
And the work you get, the studies, when you go on your website and you see the studies that have either been accomplished or in progress, they're directed by Congress, right?
About half of them are. And the other half are either done by way of working with agencies and through different procurement opportunities, or with the private sector. We've done private sector work before from organizations that wanted to, and we'll talk about one of these later today, but from organizations that wanted to bring in the Academy to highlight certain management issues or public administration challenges. But really our key customer has been Congress mm-hmm. over the years. Mm-hmm. And we've developed a very good working relationship with a number of authorizing committees and the appropriators on both the House and the Senate side. I hope we work them. Joe and I go up there probably weekly to meet with staff, meet with members to address issues and talk about what we can do to help them when it comes to their issues of trying to solve some serious management problems in the federal government.
You know, it's interesting to me because that's very that's an unknown. That's not what Congress is known for today in town. Most people, you know, who work around town think that the only thing happening in Congress is political maneuvering. And that they're really, particularly federal workers, that Congress cares about the actual administration as opposed to just picking on federal workers. They feel picked on. So the idea that you're up there once a week because members of Congress really do care about public administration, I think, is refreshing.
Well, it's been that way since I've been at the Academy since 2011, and historically it's been that way. You've always had a core group of members of Congress on both sides that have been very passionate about these issues.
And I had Tom Davis,
mm-hmm. George Voinovich, and Dan Akaka.
Right.
The last House member I worked for was John McHugh, and he was very passionate about postal reform. And public service, and now you see that he's the secretary of the long-serving secretary of the Army. And so there are members of Congress who take these things very, very seriously. I had the chance to testify a couple weeks ago before the Senate subcommittee handling federal employee issues. And while I thought that I was a little surprised by the sparse crowd, the senators that showed up were very interested in this. They were all freshmen. You had Senator Lankford, who is the chair, and he is genuinely interested in seeing how we can better the workforce. He comes from one political perspective, but the ranking Democrat is Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota. She comes from I wouldn't say a 180 degree, but she comes from a different political mm-hmm. perspective. Mm-hmm. But I think that they found some common ground there. And this was a far-reaching hearing talking about improvements in the federal workforce and what we can do to set up the federal workforce, not just improve it today, but I also think about these are issues that Congress should be thinking about and teeing up for the presidential transition.
Mm-hmm. And, we, you know, that's our next topic. We will be talking about what the what NAPA is doing with regard to planning ahead for 2016 transition, even though we're a ways away, and there's some interesting work that you and David are working on, and I do want to get to that. We're going to get to that next, but we need to take our first commercial break. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Make long-term care insurance part of your retirement plan. Long-term care is expensive, and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program offers a smart way to help protect savings and assets and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Take the next step and visit LTCFEDS.com today. That's LTCFEDS.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth, hosting today's show. Today's show focuses on the National Academy of Public Administration, NAPA. With us in the studios, Dan Blair, the president and CEO of NAPA, Joe Mitchell, who is the director of studies, and on the phone we have David Chu, who has been very involved in the work of NAPA. And actually, David, what I'd like to get to now is the work that NAPA is doing on the 2016 initiative. So if you and Dan could tee that up for us, tell our listeners what that is and what you hope to, what the expectation is of what it will address in the next presidential transition.
Well, I'm delighted, Deborah, to do that. Maybe I can offer a few words to start and turn to Dan. Essentially, what we hope to be able to do is offer to both candidates, whoever they might eventually be, the good offices of NAPA's fellows' experience in the federal government, also at the state and local level, to what you might call program implementation. In other words, how do you actually get things done? So
right.
We're not into what the policy ought to be. Mm-hmm. I recognize those would be big national issues. But once an administration has decided on its policy direction, how do you make that effective? How do you carry out the program in a way that fulfills the intent of its originators? We've all seen examples where there are good intentions, but they go off the rails in terms of what actually gets done. And the Academy has the benefit of a rich cross-section of individuals who have worked in different administrations, different cabinet agencies across the years, who can bring the benefit of their knowledge to bear on what can be effective out there. How can we be sure the federal government properly earns the respect and the support of the citizenry that pays the taxes that supports it?
Dan?
Well, I think David hit the nail on the head when he mentioned respect of the citizenry that supports the federal government today. We've seen the federal government in polls having the lowest level of trust that it has had, probably has ever had. And that this lack of trust in government feeds into the cynicism about government.
Mm-hmm.
And what we want to do is utilize this initiative as a way of turning that around. We know it can't be done in a day or a week or a year, but at least if you can have an effective and efficient transition where the new, and we're going to have the transition. We have an opportunity this time. We know we're going to have a new president. And we'll be working with both camps to make sure that, as David said, to provide the background and experience of the fellows that they can provide, not policy, but just the background on these contentious issues. But if you can start building that today and build that through the transition may just be a little bit more effective, which means that they come into office in a little bit better position than they otherwise would have. They will want to be able to identify those programs that work and don't work, and maybe identify those gaps. And as the churn of the transition continues, if we can quiet that down a bit and allow them the ability to govern, we might just be able to address and solve some of these problems. It'll allow them to have a greater attention to management, a greater attention to results, and it can get government working the way that the citizenry expects, and that can build and rebuild that level of trust.
So, David, I'm curious, from someone who served in an incredibly high-profile position in government, at a transition point, How did it get to be that NAPA's focusing on the transition between presidential administrations as a way of improving the management of government?
There are several reasons. One, of course, is that it's one thing to be outside the government looking in,
mm-hmm.
And to think that you can do X, Y, or Z. It's quite another to have actually dealt with the realities, the limits, the constraints, the challenges the government faces. So in my experience, it always looks easier from the outside than it looks when you are sitting at that desk or standing at that podium in front of the news media actually dealing with the instant issue. And I've been through, as you point out, a couple of transitions,
mm-hmm.
positions now, and both as the incoming person, I realized, oh my Lord, how little I knew of what was really going on here, and maybe the last team wasn't quite as inept as I thought it was, and had I only known X, Y, or Z earlier, I could do a better job. I've also been on the departing end, so to speak, and seeing the look of shock on the faces of newcomers who thought I'll give you a specific instance, there were budgetary savings to be had from various managed improvements. I had to tell them, look, we're already doing that.
Mm-hmm.
It's already that's already built into the estimates. If you think that's going to give you a dividend to carry out the new administration's agenda, you'll need to think again. And so the earlier there can be discussion of what are the pressing management issues, either inherited from the past or being triggered by present events, or that will arise because the directions the administration wants to take, the better off you're going to be. And that means, again, not dealing with policy choices.
Right.
Once the choices have been made, how you carry them out can make a big difference in how the program actually works.
And so is the plan to get involved with the potential new administrations before the general election, or once a candidate has been elected?
No, the plan is to do it early. As Dan has decided, we'll be reaching out pretty soon to the various campaigns that we are here. We're happy to offer you the benefit of insights NAPA has developed to the extent you're interested. That's mostly to alert the various campaigns that we are willing to be helpful. I think the focus will be on the two candidates once they emerge.
Right.
But the idea is really pre-election. Once the election has happened, at least if past is prologue, the new team will be extremely busy, and it will not be comfortable or interested in talking to a new face that shows up at that stage. So we need to build a relationship of trust with the various parties. That, again, we're not dealing with policy. We're here to help whoever wins carry out his or her policies in an effective way.
And so, Dan, what makes you think that the candidates will be interested in hearing from NAPA? That they will care at that stage of the election process about having not yet been elected, right? That they would care, as opposed to just a dialogue, as David points out, you know, the election's really a dialogue about ideas and policy, not about how to implement it when you get in. Or maybe that's what the new dialogue's going to be about.
Well, I think twofold answers to that question. One is that's why we have David. We have people involved of David's stature. He's well known in the Republican circles. He has the ability to talk, and he's respected, and people will listen. On the Democratic side, we have Ed Dasev, who served in both the Clinton and the Obama administrations. Again, he's well respected, despite who the Democratic candidate may be. They will listen, and they will listen to these folks. Yeah, we have. I've been involved in transitions. The chair of our board, Robert Shade, has been involved in transitions, and we have that. We have that fundamental. Human capital at the Academy, comprised of our fellows, that we can utilize in order to touch base with the appropriate people. But moreover,
I think one of the initiatives that we want to highlight is that when a new administration comes in, no matter who it is, there is that tendency to throw the baby out with the bathwater. They want to make their own mark in history. Anything that was associated with the past administration, even if it was of your own party, is going to be looked at skeptically. And there's this tendency to, we want to start afresh and new. And that will...
And you hear that every 4 years.
You hear that every 4 years. And the thing is that they were elected oftentimes on a change platform. But believe it or not, there are some good things going on in government today. One of the first things I think about is the evidence agenda and program evaluation. How are we evaluating the programs that work and don't work? And we want to be able to give this kind of information to the transition teams to show what improvement, what initiatives are in need of improvement, which ones are working, in an effort to say, strengthen this, and for them to make those decisions to say, strengthen this, or let's go in a different direction.
So you actually plan on going in with a developed sort of, I don't want to say agenda, but you know the programs you want to talk about. You're identifying them before you actually start talking to the candidates.
We'll be identifying some of those programs. Mm-hmm. We've actually gone out with a survey to our fellows to say, let's see, what are these areas in which we want to highlight when it comes to our transition efforts? And we'll be getting those results in, and we'll be building off of that in order to say, these are the areas that we want to focus on.
And I think really also just highlighting, the basic principles of, transformation, transition, and having fellows with the background that we have, I think is going to be very helpful to these candidates.
So you plan on formalized briefings and... discussions.
We have three legs to this initiative.
Okay.
The first leg is the effort that David and Ed are leading, and this is political in nature, but it's also it's substantive in the terms of we can provide the background information to the campaigns and to the transition teams in order for them to set the policy. And one of the ways that we're going to do that is we're partnering with the American Society for Public Administration, ASPA, which is comprised of practitioners and academics from across the country. We did this in 2012. We'll be doing this again. And these are where we can write white papers, reports, testimonies, and things, which can serve as a basis for what Ed and Dave and some other team members can do in terms of their interactions with the campaigns and transition teams. Then we're also inventorying and spotlighting the toughest jobs in government today and the incumbents. We've been doing this for the last 4 years in partnership with Ernst & Young, and it's a successor to the old Prunes book. I don't know if you remember the Prunes book. Every 4 years we come out with the Congress comes out with the Plum book. They work with OPM, and it's alternates between the House and Senate, but these are all the political positions in government. And they called it the Plum book because the cover used to be plum, but then there was also considered to be these are plum jobs.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Well, we highlighted the ones that are the most difficult. And the idea was back in the day that a prune is a seasoned plum. And we are highlighting these positions. This was originally done by the Council for Excellence in Government. And when that organization transitioned out of existence, they gave that program to us. And we've been very pleased to be able to do this. And we were updating these biographies. They're on a website called politicalappointeeproject.org. And it's very interesting to see the incumbents' views and how this is working. So this is all part of a three-legged stool, which is our transition initiative.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to circle back, it seems, with NAPA. Maybe in the fall, right?
Yeah, we'd be welcome to, happy to come back.
And, yeah, see how that worked out. I mean, it's an intriguing idea just to talk about the running of government before the person has been selected to do it. Because historically, Dan, as you point out, they start thinking about how to actually run government, operate it the day-to-day, the day after the general election. Mm-hmm. It's called the transition team. But usually, in today's, my impression, David probably, and you could speak to it differently because you actually were on transition teams. But to me, it's more like just how do you get people in place?
Well, for so long.
Getting people in place isn't necessarily, how are we going to run it?
Well, for so long, it was political suicide to talk about transition because it showed a presumptiveness on the part of the campaign that they were going to be elected. And so anything associated with the transition was always hidden or just wasn't attended to. And we've seen what's happened with bad transitions. The 2000 election, and because the court case was very truncated, and that's oftentimes highlighted as an example of that was not an efficient transition. Interestingly, the 2008 transition was very much different. GSA
probably because the Bush administration had been on the receiving end of a very bad transition and appreciated that, right?
Absolutely.
There was that learning curve.
And the president paid attention to it. The president personally was involved and directed his agency and department has to cooperate fully. But now, once you have the candidates are certified by their parties, GSA has the ability to fund those transition teams. In 2012, Governor Romney had a full-fledged transition up and running prior to the election. They had office space and a federal office building in Southwest.
And what a well-kept secret.
And it's, you know, probably the best transition that never took place. But it was very well run, very prepared that had the election gone the other way, he would have been able to step in the day after the election, put the teams in place to go into the agencies and departments and make that effort much smoother and get ahead of the curve rather than be behind it.
Mm-hmm. And you're just, NAPA's now even trying to get them even more ahead of the curve. You know, this massive thing we call government, which is generally refer to the executive branch of government, just feels, I know we have to take a break, but it just feels to me that it's getting bigger and bigger. And I don't mean person-wise, mission-wise, dollar-wise, that managing it just seems, if it were me, I'd throw my hands up and walk away and go, can't get done, you know? It feels harder and harder and more impossible to wrap your hands around. And so I see the wisdom in backing it up even earlier to start informing that person, here's how you're going to have to run your government. You know, I see that as one element to wrapping your arms around the problems that so many people have identified today with, you know, the effectiveness of how government works. Really interesting. I think I want NAPA to come back, certainly David, to talk about his experience in leg one. David, if you're willing, later on in the year, have you guys come back on the show, talk about how it played out. It's a first go. It'd be very interesting. But we do need to take our mid-show commercial break. When we come back, Joe, we're going to start talking about some of your current studies.
Happy to tell you more about our current work.
And follow up on some of the reports that have been issued. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Make long-term care insurance part of your retirement plan. Long-term care is expensive, and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program offers a smart way to help protect savings and assets and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Take the next step and visit LTCFEDS.com today. That's LTCFEDS.com.
If you're a federal law enforcement officer, then you know to do your job, you tap inside sources. To have a voice on policy and legislation, you join FLIOA. And when you want federal law enforcement officer news and up-to-date federal court decisions, you read FedAgent.com. If you aren't reading FedAgent.com, subscribe today. It's free. Don't let this source pass you by. I'm John Adler, president of the Federal Law Enforcement Officers Association, and I approve this message.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show with the National Academy of Public Administration. Today, our guests are Dan Blair. He's the president and CEO of NAPA. Joe Mitchell is the director of studies at NAPA, where he's been for 15 years. David Chu, who affiliates with NAPA as a NAPA fellow, is the president and CEO of IDA. We spent the last 15 minutes talking about the 2016 transition initiative, which was new to NAPA and sort of new to the whole concept of presidential elections and transitions. But NAPA does so much more day-to-day stuff, Joe, in its studies and the work of its fellows, and I thought we could touch on like what's current, what's going on today at NAPA.
I'm happy to do that. I would just say, as Dan and David have talked, we have a lot of activities going on, and one of those is the studies program that I lead. And just to take a step back, we get our studies from congressional directive, also from agencies coming to us, and also foundations and private entities. And they tend to focus on, you know, organizational assessments, so where an organization is, where it needs to go, strategy developments, a lot of strategic planning type activities, and implementation assistance to agencies, as well as stakeholder outreach and collaboration. And we draw upon the resource that we have in our 800 fellows. Those are individuals that, as we've talked about, have had distinguished careers at all levels of government, in academia and the private sector. They're really a national asset, and so we use those individuals when we do our studies. And so we'll form what we call a panel that usually consists of 3 to 7 fellows, depending on the size of the study, the scope, the needs. And those individuals are then also staffed by what we call a study team. And those are individuals that have had experience working in and around government. A lot of our project directors are people that were senior executives in the federal government. So what's interesting is that Congress and agencies, and really the American public in general, also get the seasoned expertise at both the panel and the study team level. And so we're really excited about, you know, being able to do that work.
And NAP has 800 fellows.
Yes.
That's a workforce. Yeah, that's a potential. That's a bench.
We try to put them to work. Yes. I can talk a little bit about.
Tell us what's going on right now.
Just a couple of the current studies.
Sure.
So we are working right now with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to help design a new undersecretary. It would be an undersecretary of agriculture for trade and foreign agricultural affairs. This was a mandate by Congress, and we are going to be reporting out in October of this year, so we're still in process. If you think about it, this is an important issue because 95% of the world's consumers live outside the United States. So trade is an important part of the American economy. And in agriculture in particular, the trade has grown from just about $29 billion in 1978 to $152 billion this past year. And that was a record. And 25% of all U.S. farm receipts are actually from trade. So yet at the same time, the agriculture's department's trade organization has not changed much, if any, since 1978. And so it was definitely time.
Well, congratulations to Congress to figuring out that there was a gap in organizational structure that didn't, meet the needs of, what was sort of happening on the ground.
Yeah.
I'm amazed to hear Congress is actually doing some of its job.
It's very good, and it's typical. You know, a lot of times agencies, I mean, the structure dates back to, you know, when programs were originally established. So you really have to keep updating these organizations, and that's the job.
So what is NAPA asked to do?
So what we're specifically doing is for this Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs is looking at options for how to structure this organization. It's a complex set of issues because you also have to look at, well, what exactly should go into this organization? And obviously you could, you know, kind of have a lighter version, you could have a medium-sized version, a heavier version. What are the implications for the other undersecretaries, the existing ones? What are the implications for the workforce? In particular, how should this undersecretary position relate to the regulatory agencies inside USDA? That would be things like the food safety and inspection and the animal and plant health and plant health.
APHIS.
So it's a challenging set of issues, but it's a really interesting project, and I'd love to come back on the program when we release the report.
When you launch,
talk in more detail.
Yeah, yes. It's interesting, and I'm a geek, I guess, because I get great pleasure in hearing that Congress actually identified a real gap in the way government was operating, not something based upon politics. You know, it wasn't just there to jibe at the executective branch and find a problem and make fun of it, but really was, you know, interested in fixing it. And the food supply, people don't really think about that. How, you know, when you think about national security issues, people think, you know, today Americans think about, you know, terrorism, right? But the food supply, if I'm running the government, the food supply is at the top of the list.
There's
Well, one of the things I wanted to point out about this, too, is also it shows you that when Congress is confronted with these complex problems, they turn to the Academy for some solutions. And one of the reasons they do that is that we can tap into that strong bench of 800 fellows. Mm. And I was just looking at who, when we do these studies, we, Joe referenced earlier, we put together a panel of fellows. We go out to all 800 fellows with a, what's called a call to fellows. We describe the project, what the skill sets we're looking at, and we get fellows actually applying to sit on these panels. And we usually get a generally robust turnout
of fellows. Response, you know, and so then we have to have the difficult job of choosing who's actually going to be on the panel, which is not always easy.
But just give me a, to give you a flavor of who's on this agriculture panel, Susan Offit, who's the chief economist at GAO, Rafael Boris, who used to be at DHS as the undersecretary for management.
Yep, he used to run the place.
Larry Cooley, who was the founder of Management Systems International, is a major, major player in the international aid world. Mac Dessler, who is a professor at the University of Maryland, and Bob Nash, who used to be the head of PPO in the Clinton administration. I mean, this is an incredible group of people. You couldn't combine these people in any other world than what you can find.
I have job envy right now.
Maybe you can come work for us.
We're oftentimes
looking for talent.
So. I have job envy. To me, again, I really come back to this. I get warmed that a warm heart that Congress, you know, there are moments when Congress is getting its job done and helping out the executive branch and the American public. And this is definitely one example.
Another
one you're working
one
on, I know, is the
doing
PTO.
Right. Now,
right.
And David is the panel chair of that, so he could speak on this as well, is a review that was requested by the Patent and Trademark Office to review their telework program. And there are really two parts to this review. There's an internal controls review, which is really looking at, you know, management controls over time and attendance and telework. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is really a broader programmatic review of looking at how effective is this program and are there differences in production from people who are working at home versus people who are working in the office. How are they managed? What are some of the issues that supervisors encounter with teleworkers? And so those are the things that we're looking at, and that report will be out next month, actually. So we'd be happy to come back and talk in more detail about that.
And David, I'd like to bring you into the conversation about PTO. I'm sure that this the work that NAPA is doing for PTO is a result of the Department of Commerce IG investigation, right, that showed that people were, quote unquote, at home teleworking, but in fact not working at all. I'm sort of curious, how has NAPA been received inside of PTO looking at this very beloved program?
With great our goodwill, I should emphasize. So we've had meetings both with seniors and working level people. They've been quite open about giving us access. They indeed, most importantly, I don't want to talk to results because it's not appropriate till we release the report.
Right.
But let me speak to one of the instruments, which was they allowed us to do a survey of their some of their personnel about how PTO actually how the especially the telework aspect of PTO actually works, and that will be a powerful part of the final report. So yes, they have been subject to considerable shall we say review, putting it mildly,
yeah,
of the telework program and what may or may not be happening. I also think this is getting a little bit ahead of the report. I think we want to wait for some of the facts to be presented before we reach any conclusions about what's actually happening.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just urge turning down the temperature a little bit on the issue and let the report findings help us guide to a good future here. But you're right. PTO's approach to its responsibilities very much does hinge on making telework effective, and they are very keen on continuing the program.
Yeah, and sort of for me, the juxtaposition, David, that I find very interesting is that for the last 2 years, PTO made for the agency of its size, it made number one best places to work. It was a year or two ago, I guess when they made the list the first time, their chief human capital officer's name, I forgot. He's a great guy. I actually hosted the show. And I remember one of the things he pointed to that he attributed to having such a high morale in his workforce was a very robust, strong, and well-respected telework program. And then you fast forward like 2 years later and you see the IG sort of take it down. I got concerned about that issue of employee morale and engagement. There's a direct consequence to the success of the agency.
You're absolutely right. PGO management does put great stock in it, but let me ask you to wait for the report's findings for us to comment on the challenge you've offered.
Yeah, and I actually, as an employer and as an employment lawyer, I'm always interested in the sort of opposing views about telework, which is, you know, from the employer's perspective, if you're not there, often you're, the accessibility of having you deal with an issue that arises, you know, they're what they call lost opportunities. I think it's an incredible, I know that OPM's position is to promote telework programs across government, but I do think that finding the right balance so that you have the employees that you need where you need them when things happen, I think is very challenging for any employer, particularly an employer the size of the executive branch. So I think a lot of people are going to be looking at what you have to say.
Well, we look forward to being able to report.
And when you report, we'll be sure to make sure somehow we get you back on.
Yeah,
welcome. Hopefully you won't get tired of us.
Summer, yeah. Aren't we?
Right. Well, I mean, that telework program was held up as, you know, one of the best in government. It's in part what got PTO to best places to work. And then the IG just, you know, whether, you know, I'm skeptical about IG reports. I think there's, you know, there's alarm bells being sent off through cross government by IGs that sometimes the histrionics are not helpful. So I think it's going to be, when I saw that NAPA was actually studying what the issues were that got raised in the IG report, I thought, won't this be interesting to see the juxtaposition between the Commerce IG report and what NAPA has to say? So, David, all eyes are on you.
Okay.
Or at least our eyes.
No pressure otherwise.
Right. We're going to take the final break for our show. When we come back, we're going to talk about some of the other work and studies that NAPA is engaged in. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Make long-term care insurance part of your retirement plan. Long-term care is expensive, and it's not covered by traditional types of insurance plans. With benefits designed specifically for the federal family, the Federal Long-Term Care Insurance Program offers a smart way to help protect savings and assets and remain independent should you need long-term care services someday. Start planning for the future. Take the next step and visit LTCFEDS.com today. That's LTCFEDS.com.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Deborah Roth. I'm hosting today's show. Today we have with us in the studio and on the line the National Academy of Public Administration. We have Dan Blair, who's their president and CEO. We have Joe Mitchell, who is the director of studies, and David Chu, who is the president and CDO of IDA, and the co-chair, we're all going to be watching, David, the co-chair of the PTO report that I understand will be coming out soon on telework. Joe, circling back to you, I know that there's a report in particular that you find to be very interesting and insightful about maybe a lot of the work NAPA's doing, and I thought we'd touch on that
now. Well, I thought that this was as a good one to kind of frame a lot of the issues that we're facing in the public sector, and that is our recent Federal Digital Insight Survey. We partnered with ICF International on this work, and last year we surveyed a randomly selected group of federal leaders, civil servants at the GS-13 and above level, and we had some really interesting findings. It was interesting that you know, we're saying around the office, you know, technology has won. Federal employees are digital workers. They embrace technology and its benefits. I think sometimes that's not the popular conception, but it is the case. Over 90% said it had improved productivity. And about 90% said that it was helping them in serving agency stakeholders. They also view digital technology as a business imperative. They really think that it's very important. However, just over 40% said that their agency was dedicating appropriate resources to digital technology. So there's a concern, and that's also related to just a broader concern that the federal government may not be able to keep pace with change in the private sector relative to the private sector. What's interesting is only 15%.
You mean with regard to technology?
Yes. Only 15% said their agency was making new technology available to its employees at the same pace as the private sector. So that's a big gap that we'll need to fill. Some of that was ascribed to slow acquisition processes that were seen as barriers to digital technology. Another interesting finding was that federal leaders themselves believe that they are adequately trained on the use of technology, but they're concerned that the workforce as a whole is not. So that highlighted some training issues. And then the last thing, and you and I had a conversation about this before the show, was the whole issue of work-life balance and kind of the double-edged sword of this technology. A little over a third said that the technology had harmed their work-life balance.
Because they have to answer an email.
Yeah. Constantly.
You know, they feel the need to answer an email at 11 o'clock at night when I'm sure that email could, that's my version, could have waited to tomorrow morning.
A third, however, said that it had helped. And I think that that's probably, you know, it's that vacation that you're taking and you're working on your vacation and you're thinking, well, it's because of this technology that I'm working. But
right.
at the same time, maybe it's because of that technology that you can take the vacation.
Right. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough that I've been working, going to work every day as a lawyer here in the law firm for 25 years. And I have a faint memory, it's getting fainter every day, about working before computers, before at the advent of voicemail. Like, I remember the advent of voicemail when it went from the tape recorder machine to now you actually had your own voicemail that you could listen to, as opposed to a secretary taking a message for every call that came in. But my point about all that is that because of technology, the pace of work is like a million times faster. Of what a worker is expected to get done correctly is like a million times faster than when I went to work 25 years ago. And I think that, remember that conversation,
yeah,
Joe, you
absolutely.
And I had before the show, you know, part of it is, you know, an appreciation for what your job really does require. But on the other hand, things do happen much faster in today's economy.
They do.
And they don't necessarily wait for you to come back for your from your vacation.
Yeah, it's a real challenge. And I think a lot of it comes down to supervisors and what the supervisors expect. And if the supervisors are sending emails at all hours, then people think that as an employee, I need to be responding at all hours. So it was interesting, the work-life balance, that about a third said it had harmed, about a third had said it had helped, and then about a third said that it hadn't had an impact.
Yeah. And now this is the Federal Digital Insights Report.
Yes. And what we're going to do is we're going to do this.
It's online.
It is online. It's on our website. And we're going to do the survey again this year. And we're hoping that it will be an annual survey. Again, we're working with ICF International on this. And we think that now that we've got a good baseline, it'll be really interesting to see how these issues evolve over time.
Right. And what I like is how this relates, the survey and its findings relate to some of the other work that NAP is doing and has done. You know, the idea of how technology pushes the expectation of workflow, efficiency, service to citizens.
Well, think about the PTO work we're doing. You couldn't telework without this kind of digital technology. And I was laughing and thinking about the workplace of 25 years ago. I started a little bit before you, but I remember walking into my office and you had typists, and they were on the Selectrix, which were considered to be far superior to the old electric typewriters, which came after the manual Royals. And so it's just evolution of the federal workplace. And the other thing is that if you look at the workplace of 50 years ago, we were an army of clerk typists. I mean, that's the kind of worker that was in the federal
government.
And
the civil service exam worked well because it was how many words could you type correctly in a minute? I mean, it did work well then.
It did work well because you improved year after year after year, but we still have that same system too. So that's why, just another agenda is to look at how can we reform the civil service to reflect what we have in terms of the workforce today and to meet the needs of government today.
And I think that that's a good segue to the last report I would just highlight, which was our Social Security study, where the request to Congress.
Where people like me, at the very bottom of the baby boomer generation, I'm sitting there saying, I better get my benefits when it's my turn.
Well, we were focusing on much, much more. We were focusing on really the service delivery of this, which obviously we hope that there are benefits
for all
of us.
Sure, and at the end of the baby boomer generation, most of the baby boomers at the top of the generation will still be alive. And you think about the swell of people being serviced by the Social Security Administration is just growing.
Well, and what's interesting, we were asked to look at, really, how should services be delivered in the 2025 to 2030 timeframe? So looking out into the future. And what's interesting is that people, the panel that we formed for this really had a vision that was much more provide quality digital services, quality virtual services as much as possible, online, phone, video conference, while of course having personal delivery where needed and where appropriate. But in the future, people are really going to want to be served in a different way. People are not going to want to go to a Social Security office unless they need to, and so. Our vision was really, trying to balance. Obviously, you've got to have those services available for people who need the in-person, but you've got to make sure that there is a way that people can obtain those services through other means. And increasingly, as people, we're going to have this technology that's going to allow us to do that.
Mm-hmm. It's very technology-driven in part.
Yes, it is. And I think that it's a challenge, that study was interesting too, because it really got into futures and looking out to the future obviously is difficult, it's challenging, but it's something that we were really happy to do. And Social Security Administration is also doing some of that work too. And so we hope that, other agencies will start doing futures work because I think that services will be delivered in a different way in the future because people are going to demand that.
Yeah. And one of the things, Joe, before the show, when we talked about this, I equated it to was investing in infrastructure, roads, tunnels, and bridges. To me, this is a part of the infrastructure of the American economy. You don't hear Congress saying, they say, I want it to work better, but with all that technology, how are they going to fund it? And that's been the number one concern of many Americans, is this infrastructure in our country's, not keeping up. It's decaying. It needs to get funded. When I looked at your report for the Social Security Administration, I was like, well, that's going to cost some money.
Well, it will. There are certainly some upfront investments, but I think that there can be a lot of savings over the longer term as well as a result of that.
Right. And of course, that's for another study, right?
Or at least another time on Federal News Radio.
So we've come to the end of the show. I want to thank everyone for joining me today. David, thank you so much for being a guest. And we're looking forward to your PTO report. And Dan and Joe, we do hope that later on in the year, especially as we head into 2016, we'll get a read back on the 2016 Presidential Transition Initiative.
We'd love to come back and talk to you about the progress we've made.
Sure. Thanks for all the good work
you
do.
Thank you so much.
Deborah.